This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for the week ending 27 May 2016 for Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace radio tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With global extreme weather as the organizing principle, Sequitur covers habitat destruction, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as a result of human activity. Sequitur moves from our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels to a place of acceptance of the natural consequences of those actions. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zimpht, that's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. More of his work is linked at panina.org, or you can find him on SoundCloud. The Washington Post reports that about 4 billion people already live in areas suffering from water stress. The World Bank predicts that by 2030, quote, the world may face a shortfall in water availability of approximately 2,700 billion cubic meters, with demand exceeding current sustainable water supplies by 40%, close quote. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology frames this as 52% of the world's population living under water stress by mid-century. WAPO continues, quote, though the bank tamps down speculation that countries will fight with one another for water, it warns that water scarcity could encourage other sorts of conflict and dislocation, such as civil wars, unquote. According to Pacific Standard, agriculture already accounts for 70% of water withdrawals globally. Water withdrawals from energy production are expected to increase by about 20% by 2035, but consumption will rise by a more dramatic 85% due not only to population growth, but also due to adoption of a post-industrial Western diet by emerging Eastern economies. The Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities launched a commission funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and chaired by North Carolina State University Chancellor Randy Woodson, with a mandate to support three pillars of food security: access, availability, and utilization. According to MSU Today, quote, the Earth's population is expected to surpass 9 billion by 2050. That population will demand nutrition produced with no more land or water than exists today, with the additional challenges expected to be posed by climate change, including extreme weather, drought, and pests. Close quote. But according to a World Peace Foundation analysis reported in Take Part, 90% of the 115 million people who died of starvation between 1870 and 1980 did so not because of drought or flood, but, quote, as a result of imperial conquest, great wars, or repression under totalitarian regimes, unquote. A death rate of 2 people per day per 10,000 population is the criterion for declaring a famine. And in Ethiopia, for example, the worst drought in 3 decades has resulted in food shortages, but no dramatic increases in the mortality rate, according to the foundation's executive director, Alex DeWall. The causes of famine often have more to do with politics and stability in a country than with agriculture. While it's important for researchers to adapt crops to a changing climate, food insecurity won't end because of innovations like drought-resistant corn alone. A report this week by the United Nations Environment Program warns that, quote, swelling populations and demand for food combined with ever scarcer water and land resources could lead to a doubling of food prices and trigger civil unrest in some developing countries, close quote, especially Morocco, Bangladesh, Tunisia, and Indonesia, as demand for high-impact food increases disproportionately in wealthy countries such as the U.S. and emerging economies such as China and India in the face of diminishing supply, reports Reuters. The highest percentage of loss to GDP is expected in Benin, Nigeria, Ivory Coast, Senegal, and Ghana, While the GDP of wealthy countries might actually benefit from this crisis of their own creation. Not to be outdone for recognition at the pity party, a recent study published in the Journal of Climatic Changes finds Europe at risk for climate change, especially in the Southwest, especially on the Mediterranean seaboard, reports the Extinction Protocol blog. Based on a 2C rise in global temperature, the study predicts that so-called 100-year extreme weather events will increase in frequency to twice a year in Spain, for example. A study published this week in the Clinical Journal of the American Society of Nephrology links regional temperature spikes with surges in the incidence of kidney disease and higher risk of death by kidney failure, reports the Denver Post. This is among the first studies to show a causal connection between global warming and a specific illness. Happy National Extreme Heat Week! The National Resources Defense Council reports that the Federal Emergency Management Agency has added extreme heat to its list of natural disasters. Monday is Memorial Day, a federal holiday in recognition of those who died in service to the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Armed Forces. While I offer my condolences to the bereaved, a few lines from Julia Ward Howe's 1870 Mother's Day proclamation will explain why, as a nonviolent anarchist and peace activist, I neither offer gratitude to the departed nor otherwise celebrate this holiday. Quote, "We will not have questions answered by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands will not come to us reeking with carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We, the women of one country, will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of a devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor, nor violence indicate possession." Close quote. At the Climate Action Summit in Washington, D.C. earlier this month, World Bank sources said that cities are woefully unprepared for the anticipated surge in natural disasters, putting 1.3 billion people and $158 trillion in assets at risk. Disaster risk is affected by three factors. 1. Hazard, the frequency of potentially dangerous naturally occurring events such as earthquakes or tropical cyclones, increasing due to climate change. 2. Exposure, the size of the population and the economic assets located in hazard-prone areas, going up as more people are living in hazardous areas. 3. Vulnerability, the susceptibility of the exposed elements to the natural hazard, on the rise because of badly designed and poorly planned housing. The surge looks like a tenfold increase in financial losses in the 10-year period from 2005 to 2014, as compared to the 10-year period from 1976 to 1985, and a threefold increase in the number of fatalities. Densely populated coastal cities are sinking at a time when sea levels are rising. The agency projects that the annual cost of natural disasters in 136 coastal cities could increase from $6 billion in 2010 to $1 trillion in 2070, reports The Guardian. Judith Enck, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator of District 2, which includes New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands, addressed the New Jersey Bar Association about challenges associated with climate change, from the northward spread of the Zika virus to the economics of agriculture and real estate, reports the Press of Atlantic City. She says it's also an ethical issue, since climate change disproportionately affects the poor. But there is no question of belief in climate change. It is, quote, "settled science. There's nothing theological about it," close quote. Yet she still believes that sustainable economic growth is possible on a finite planet with stronger enforcement of regulations such as the Clean Energy Plan that has been bogged down in court proceedings and is therefore only voluntarily operational on a state-by-state basis. The case is on the Washington, D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals 27 December docket. The impact of a court finding that the Clean Energy Plan is unconstitutional would be devastating to the rash of lawsuits from coast to coast and around the world that seeks to find governments guilty of criminal neglect for ignoring the threat of climate change to health and safety. The New York Times reported that the suit by Our Children's Trust on behalf of 21 children and teenagers will go forward in spite of attempts by the federal government and the fossil fuel companies to have it dismissed. Michael B. Girard, the director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia Law School, said, quote, "It is the first time a federal court has suggested that government may have a constitutional duty to combat climate change and that individuals can sue to enforce that right," close quote. Similar suits are pending in Pakistan and in New Zealand. Meanwhile, WCAX reports that legislation has been introduced in the state of New York to require reductions of greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by 2030, en route to 100% renewable energy by mid-century. It would appear from a report in the Wall Street Journal that Exxon and Chevron, the two biggest federal contractors to the tune of hundreds of millions of tax dollars per year, are getting squeezed from both sides. Their shareholders are meeting this week to vote on measures to require more disclosure of the risks to profitability of new government rules about emissions control. At the same time, the government is proposing new disclosure rules about the climate risks of the corporation's business practices. While Canada pledged a 30% emissions cut at the Paris summit in December, data show that my neighbors to the north are more likely to increase emissions 19% over 2005 levels by 2030, based on policies in place as of last September, reports Climate Change News, with the transport and oil and gas sectors accounting for nearly 50%. Environmental Chief Catherine McKenna has proposed a national price on carbon, and the Fort McMurray fires possibly swayed public opinion in the direction of capping extraction from the Alberta tar sands. But neighboring Manitoba and oil-rich Saskatchewan oppose any new taxes or restrictions, as do Ontario and Quebec, who already have carbon dioxide emission pricing systems in place. Ontario, Canada's most populous province at 14 million people, passed cap-and-trade legislation last Wednesday that aims to cut greenhouse gas emissions 37% from 1990 levels by 2030 and 80% by 2050, and that is expected to launch next March and ultimately link up with Quebec and California's carbon market, with all of the proceeds estimated at $2 billion per year to be invested in renewable energy and building insulation. Let's hope they have better luck with their pollution monetization scheme than Australia did. The Huffington Post reprinted the eloquent plea Fiji delivered to the first annual humanitarian summit in Istanbul this week. On behalf of developing island nations worldwide, Fiji asked two things of overdeveloped nations. One is to expedite the ratification of the Paris Accord, and the other is to lower the cap on global warming from 2°C to 1.5°C. On their own behalf, they protested the injustice of their ineligibility for adaptation financing due to their prosperity relative to places like Tuvalu and the Marshall Islands, in spite of the enormity of the threat to which they are inevitably exposed, saying it's as if they are being punished for their development success. Tonga Online reports that this summit was attended by 200 delegates from 15 Pacific Island governments who are looking to world leaders to commit to five core responsibilities: prevent and end conflict, respect the rules of war, leave no one behind, work differently to end need, and invest in humanity. Tonga is the third most vulnerable nation in the world and will focus on risk reduction. The U.S. is the leading humanitarian donor, with contributions of nearly $26 billion in the past five fiscal years, A press release by the White House briefing room declares the U.S. committed to three primary objectives. 1. Reduce the impact of conflict on civilians, with special attention to the impact on women and girls, and reaffirm our country's long-standing commitment to international humanitarian law? Say what? 2. Strengthen the international humanitarian system, including how it is resourced and its effectiveness in addressing needs. 3. Improve coherence between humanitarian and development assistance to better address recurring and protracted crises. Last Thursday, after 2 years of debate, the Canadian National Energy Board laid out 157 conditions for approval of the $6.8 billion Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion. The next step in the legislative process is Prime Minister Trudeau's approval, reports 680 News. The only credible support that's being offered for the project is about jobs, especially in construction, and export of resources, especially to China. The Catholic Church took a leadership role in the Break Free demonstrations last weekend to overthrow King Coal in the Philippines, a country where 75% are Catholic, reports Reuters. They were joined by the 5% Muslim minority. As part of their ongoing protest against major funding of Britain's foremost cultural institutions by BP, a Greenpeace demonstration was successful last week in forcing a half-day delay in the opening of the British Museum's Sunken Cities, Egypt's Lost World exhibit, rebranding it the Sinking Cities exhibit, and displaying topical images of present-day climate change disasters such as New Orleans, Louisiana, and Hebden Bridge, West Yorkshire, reports the Financial Times. Science Daily reports that fish can adapt more readily to increased cold than to increased heat. The Weather Channel reports that India will engineer the water flow of its greatest rivers, including the Ganges and the Brahmaputra, to break the drought that has gripped half of its states with a combined population of 250 million after 2 years or four crop cycles of failed monsoons. These rivers arise from glacial melt, and 54 of India's 56 rivers flow through Bangladesh before emptying into the Bay of Bengal. 3,000 to 5,000 Indian farmers have committed suicide during the same period due to rising debt and failing crops, with a disproportionately high number of these in the state of Maharashtra, home to my little birthday girl Santini. In the first 3 months of 2016, there were 116 suicides, which looked like a possible healing trend from the nearly 3,000 in calendar year 2015, until 3 weeks in April saw 65 in the Marathwada district alone, climbing to 36 in a single week earlier in May, and bringing the year-to-date total to 454, 100 more than during the corresponding period of last year, according to the Indian Express. And that's in addition to more than 370 deaths so far this year from extreme heat, according to ValueWalk. Elsewhere in India, the Center for Holistic Development reports that 377 homeless people have died in Delhi in the past 45 days, possibly due to the heat wave, which puts this year on target to match last year's 550 for the months of April and May combined, reports the Hindustan Times. Inverse reports that Iowa State University psychologists are proposing a link between heat waves and increased criminal aggression. However, Florida State University research reached a contrary conclusion based on the finding that people have a tendency to stay indoors when it gets hot outside, as if domestic violence doesn't count as criminal aggression. And as a team from the University of Michigan demonstrated, time of day is a critical factor, with behavior becoming less predictable early and late in the day, even when very high temperatures keep people relatively subdued during the midday hours. But the Times of India reports that Delhi got a break on Monday with a dust storm followed by drenching showers. One person died and five more were injured in two separate structural collapses. The Times also reported a die-off of 300 bats in Dungarpur and extraordinary measures being taken at zoos throughout the region, including temporary closures, especially for the well-being of the lions and tigers and bears. Oh my! Before moving on to the rest of the world, let's take a musical break for a birthday greeting for Santini. Happy first birthday, little angel. The heaviest rains in 25 years triggered landslides in Sri Lanka last weekend that have killed more than 100 people, with 100 more still missing, reports News First. Almost 120,000 are in temporary shelters after losing their homes, and as many as a third of a million have been internally displaced. Three entire villages were buried, 531 houses were lost, and almost 5,000 more were damaged. The military was deployed to assist in rescue operations. There is a threat of increased incidents of rat fever. While local P2P apps are in widespread grassroots use, the Sri Lanka Red Cross pioneered the use of social media at scale in response to this disaster, reports Reuters. For example, the national government and media trailed social media by about 72 hours in mobilizing an official response. And by the way, if the reports you read have conflicting information about the number of casualties, it could be due to dismemberment of bodies by the forces to which they've been subjected, or to the difficulty in knowing how to attribute the fragments, especially in landslide situations where an entire mountainside descends on a village whose buildings are less than structurally sound. AccuWeather reports that this weather system organized itself into Cyclone Roanu as it crossed northward, pulled the record-breaking heat across the subcontinent from the India-Pakistan border, where the temperature was in excess of 50°C or 123°F late last week, and slammed into Bangladesh, where the death toll stands at 26, according to the tablet. 500,000 people had been evacuated into 3,500 homes in advance of the storm, and another 250,000 were marooned by floodwaters that were sometimes tinged bright green by toxic industrial waste as a 1-meter storm surge and torrential rain coursed through urban districts. Another 13 were killed in Hunan Province, China, by Roanu. Naimul Haq, writing for In-Depth News, compares the predicted 86-centimeter sea level rise and 90-centimeter storm surges in low-lying coastal areas of Bangladesh with a seawall more than 4 meters high and seems to find the people who are migrating inland lacking in the courage to fight climate change with salt-resistant crops and such agricultural innovations. In spite of risk assessment findings that Bangladesh is the number one most vulnerable country to the effects of climate change, it seems to me that it should be obvious that salinity will ruin agricultural lands long before the sea level rises enough to physically inundate people's homes. The ones who are leaving now are to be commended, not ridiculed. China is having severe drought in the north and flooding in the south. The meteorology department says this is a typical pattern for El Niño, but the magnitude is likely the highest in history. CCTV reports rain over most of the country this weekend. CNN reports that at least 7 people have died and 2 more are critically injured after Indonesia's Mount Sinabung erupted on Saturday. University of Melbourne climate scientist Andrew King is calling for continued warmer temperatures throughout Australia for the rest of the calendar year, with cooler temperatures and an increase in tropical cyclone activity if El Niño is followed by La Niña, reports news.com. The Australia Bureau of Meteorology declared the 2015-2016 El Niño officially dead this week, reports Carbon Brief. Meanwhile, Perth and Western Australia had 3 separate waves of flooding with thunderstorms, damaging winds, and high tides this week, reports EcoGreen Data. Professor Kim Cobb at Georgia Tech says that due to the incredible heat from the first 4 months of 2016, this year is on course to be the hottest year ever, in spite of the increasing likelihood of a cooling La Niña event. After El Niño drought caused mass displacement in northern Colombia, South America, April has seen more than 300 La Niña events such as wind and hailstorms, avalanches, landslides, and flash floods, according to Colombia reports. Colombia's Meteorology Institute has raised the probability of La Niña to 76%, with, quote, strong and abundant rain, unquote, by the last quarter of this year. Winter arrived in New Zealand last weekend with 8-meter waves and temperatures in the teens Celsius, reports Stuff. Details are sparse because the Banks Peninsula weather data collecting station was damaged by high winds. The Jerusalem Post reports that Israel had a weather roller coaster this week with repeated cycling between unusually high and unusually cool temperatures. It was not The Onion, but rather The National, that carried a story about plans in the United Arab Emirates to build a 2,000-meter mountain to encourage rainfall. Say what? It would take 10 years of 24/7, 365 work, cost between 5 and 7 billion euros, and weigh in at 5 trillion kilograms. But as anyone knows who lives in mountainous regions, such a scheme could actually work in principle. A classic example is found in South America, where rainforests to the east of the Andes are balanced by the bone-dry Atacama Desert to the west. These two opposing tendencies are called the orographic effect and the phone effect, respectively. I'm laughing as I'm reading a report in the UK Mirror that calls for record-breaking heat in the British Isles this summer, again reversing previous forecasts. The Weather Network predicts above-average temperatures for southern and western Canada, but the east and north will be cooler than normal. Long-range forecasts are similarly contradictory for Washington, D.C., with some models calling for a 50% increase in the number of days with 32°C or higher temperatures, while those based on Karen McKinnon's Pacific Extreme Pattern model are calling for cooler than normal temperatures, according to Jason Salmonow of the Washington Post. Canada is experiencing both severe drought and wildfires in the west and torrential rains in the east, with the line of demarcation running from Hudson Bay to the Great Lakes, reports AccuWeather, although CBC reports a much-needed rainy week in Edmonton this week, with more precipitation in 7 days than in the preceding 7 months. Paul Roundy of the State University of New York at Albany attributes the Alberta fires to El Niño, and warns that the reflexive attribution of severe weather to climate change puts the wide acceptance of climate science at risk. The Canada National Bank says the wildfires in Alberta and Saskatchewan are likely to result in a negative GDP for this quarter, reports the Weather Network. A decrease of 4 million barrels of oil production per day has resulted in a modest and probably temporary recovery of oil prices to $50 per barrel due to the effect of the fires, together with unrest in other oil-producing countries such as Nigeria, Libya, and Venezuela. The wildfire situation in Alberta continues to worsen, with 40 new wildfire starts on Monday alone and more than 522,000 hectares affected, with an additional 2,496 hectares scorched in Saskatchewan. Current estimates suggest total losses could be as high as $9 billion, making this the costliest disaster in Canada's history. Survey results released last week by the Royal Bank of Canada and reported in Vice indicate that 52% of Albertans said oil is Canada's most important natural resource. In Calgary, headquarters for Suncor and other energy giants, 55% of survey respondents chose oil. Fewer than 30% chose water. Meanwhile, in the rest of Canada, an average of 49% of respondents said fresh water is Canada's top resource, with Winnipeggers coming on strongest for water at 62%. Torontonians were the most concerned about extreme weather and lake water quality at 70 and 84%, respectively. Alaska Dispatch reports snow in the interior region of the state, with a temperature nosedive to just below freezing after a high of 27 C over the weekend. More than 5 million acres of Alaska were lost to wildfires in 2015, more than the total in all of the lower 48, according to Alaska Dispatch News. In a recent report, the Anchorage Fire Department learned that the lengthening of season, increase in size, and spread and geographic extent over the last 65 years were closely correlated with increasing temperatures. Topography is also a factor, with steep slopes creating wind chutes and chimneys that contribute to ignition and spread of wildfires. Interestingly, when it comes to building proximity to trees, a 4.5 meter distance is an adequate fire break for deciduous woods, while 24 meters is recommended for conifers. 24/7 Wall Street lists the seven most notorious of the United States in terms of dangerous weather. In reverse order, they are Mississippi, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Wyoming, Nevada, Missouri, and in first place, Alabama. Nationwide, since 1988, there have been 3,806 heat-related fatalities compared to 830 deaths attributable to extreme cold. Many of these states are located in Tornado Alley, where hundreds were killed in an outbreak in 2011. All seven had weather fatality rates at least double the national average during the 5 years that were analyzed. Florida is absent from this list despite its tendency to flood. Last Wednesday saw heavy storms and strong winds with downed power lines and outbuildings lifted and thrown a dozen meters, but no injuries or fatalities, reports NBC Miami. Last weekend saw similar weather in the Midwest and Middle Atlantic regions as far south as central Appalachia. Two people were critically injured in a tornado in Kansas on Tuesday, reports ABC News. Some 26 tornadoes touched down across the plains, mostly in Michigan, Colorado, Texas, Oklahoma, and Nebraska, in addition to Kansas. Damaging hail was also reported by Nine News. According to Steve Key, Director of Media and Digital Communications at Insurance Bureau of Canada, disaster claim payouts are expected to reach $1 billion annually, up from $40 million in the 1970s, reports Insurance Business America. The annual increase has been, hello, exponential since 2009. The Liverpool Times reports that lack of agency coordination, sluggish information flow, and limited funding combined to create inadequate disaster response to the flooding in that region last fall, according to an independent investigation, which called for improvements in preparedness, early warning systems, and response strategies. Anybody want to hazard a guess as to who funded that investigation? At an annual meeting this week, Executive Director of Oxfam South Africa, Sipho Mthathi, urged the African Development Bank to provide, quote, increased financing of clean and sustainable energy, especially off-grid renewables, which can be quickly deployed and are often cheaper than electricity from the grid, close quote, reports the Lusaka Times. She also urged more support for smallhold farmers, especially women, and added, quote, large public-private partnerships are attractive, but the human costs of them are too high. According to PBS, 90% of disasters in the U.S. involve flooding. Flood insurance was nationalized in 1968 under the National Flood Insurance Program, administered by the Federal Emergency Management Agency in one of those devastating public-private partnership arrangements. This week, FEMA published a proposal to overhaul its relationship with the insurance companies. The key term, of course, is proposal. Over the last 11 years, fraud, waste, abuse, and mismanagement, along with rising costs and a shrinking budget, have resulted in increased requirements for less than adequate coverage and a $23 billion debt resulting from the difference between premiums collected and claims paid out. Meanwhile, the insurance companies who manage the program make hundreds of millions in profits, 10% climbing to more like 30% in the wake of major disasters like Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Sandy, while the annual cost of living increase in my Social Security pension varies from 2% in prosperous times down to zero for 2016 and for three consecutive years about 10 years ago. FEMA's taxpayer-subsidized insurance program will pay up to $250,000 for damage to the home and up to $100,000 for damage to the contents, where the key term is up to. Amounts in excess of these are also paid by the taxpayer when a disaster is declared. And in a bizarre sort of catch-22, purchase of a policy is a condition of federally backed mortgages in certain high-risk areas, yet homeowners' applications for coverage can be turned down if their community has failed to take flood mitigation measures. Again, drawing the analogy with health insurance, doesn't this sound a bit like the refusal of insurers to cover so-called pre-existing conditions? This is corporate welfare, with the cost borne by the taxpayers, present and past. But the sheeple love the false sense of safety that is sold to them by the insurance industry. Thanks for following Sequitur on Expressions of Peace Radio, archived at panina.org. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston. Thank you.
Science Ear. Follow it back to the zero field. There's only metaphors and puns. It tells us then that there is no seeking, 'cause what connects us is one.